Welcome to the Daily Friend Show, offering insightful and thought-provoking news commentary and analysis from a classically liberal centrist perspective. The show is brought to you by the Institute of Race Relations. Tune in at 4:30 every Monday to Thursday for engaging discussions from our team of analysts and researchers that you won't find anywhere else.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and I'm joined today by Mr. Gabriel Krauser. Gabriel, how are you this fine, warm Tuesday in Joburg?
Very good. Thanks, Nicholas. Not as hot as you, but getting there, enjoying it.
Yes, now I'm rather baking under my soundproofing blanket. And Mr. Terence Corrigan. Terence, how are you doing on this scorching day?
I'd probably prefer winter, but, you know, then I'd be complaining that it's too cold. But getting by.
Very good. All right. So let's get into it, into our topics for today. And the first one is an interesting story coming out of the University of Cambridge. The University of Cambridge has done a study which has found that young people are less satisfied with democracy and more disillusioned than at any time in the past century, especially in Europe, North America, Africa, and Australia. Millennials, in other words, people born between 1981 and 1996, are more disillusioned than Gen X, who were born between 1965 and 1981, or baby boomers, who are the generation before them, or the interwar generation, who are before them. The study found, quote, across the world, younger generations are not only more dissatisfied with democratic performance than the old, but also more discontented than previous generations at a similar life stage. The picture is bad in the United States, Brazil, Mexico, South Africa, France, Australia, and the United Kingdom. However, satisfaction increased in Germany, South Korea, and many of the post-communist countries of Eastern Europe, so places like Poland and the Czech Republic. So some people have speculated, the study goes on to speculate that part of this is due to wealth inequality and lack of income, saying that millennials are not as wealthy as baby boomers, at least in terms of percentage. Terence, what should we make of this? What do you think is driving young people to be so disillusioned with democracy?
Well, I think that the economic fallout is definitely a factor. You know, the trajectory, I think, in most capitalist democracies has been generally that you could expect to be doing better than your parents. And I think that in a sense has reversed itself, or at least that's the perception.
Sorry, Terence, we seem to have lost you there. You said there seems to be, this trend seems to have reversed.
Yeah. Joe Biden said something very interesting a couple of years ago about how, why was his wife the first person to go to university? Turns out you cribbed that from Neil Kinnock, but anyway. But the thing is that his generation, Neil Kinnock's generation, they were doing better than their parents. A university education, you know, was desirable, and it was a means of mobility. You know, now we've got many of those bells and whistles. In the developed world, higher education participation is probably beyond where it's ever been. Yet, so much of the stuff that would have opened doors for you in the 1980s is now being done by artificial intelligence. There's a lot of frustration that, you know, despite the capacity of the world to produce wealth as never before, the ability to you know, get in on the ground floor and see a steady upward movement, you know, it's more complex than it was in the past. Many of those entry level positions that my parents might have gone into weren't available by the time I was there, and, you know, certainly aren't available now. And I think, you know, add to that there's been a veritable home industry made of grievance. in a sense, I think that many of the many established democracies, and South Africa, I think, is a special case. Is a special case in that respect. They become very, very comfortable, and you know, you are able to turn your attention to issues of esteem or of status, which your previous generations would probably have given rather less less concern to. Interestingly, in South Africa, we know that from Afrobarometer's surveys, something like 60% upwards of the country would of people in South Africa would trade democracy for a strong man who could provide jobs, houses, and economic security.
Gabriel, firstly, do you agree with Terence's analysis? And secondly, what do you think explains this difference between why countries like the United States, South Africa, France are seeing less enthusiasm for democracy, and yet countries like Poland and Germany and South Korea are seeing more enthusiasm for democracy?
Right. I think that Terence is spot on. We've seen shifts in the property economy, AI, increasingly poorly trained people that are well accredited and have expensive educations, but that don't really give them the skill sets to add value. More and more of that's a problem. And on the esteem market side, we see more praise going to the gnashing of teeth and the beating of chests and declaring oneself a victim in perpetuity, and less esteem going to people who add value through hard work or through, amazing talent and insight. What is the driver for this and the differentiator, therefore, between those countries where you've seen this dip in respect for democracy and those countries where it continues to be on the up? I think that one might want to look to the third sort of basic realm of social interaction, and that is force. So Germany and the Eastern European former Soviet Union bloc, of which Germany was half part, are different from France and the US and the UK and so on, in that they more recently had proper national violent turmoil, or at least a proper change in the central coordination of violence, a change in government, a revolution. And the revolution that they had was precisely from autocratic socialist oversight towards democracy. And in part that happened because in Germany people had been voting with their feet for decades, going from the socialist authoritarian Eastern Bloc to the democratic, more free market Western half of Germany, or Western part of Germany. And eventually the ultra-left couldn't hold, and the center regained proper respect in those countries. And so I think there's just more people who have it in living memory, what it's like, what the alternative to democracy is like. South Korea is not all that different. It wasn't really a democracy until the late 80s, maybe even the very early 90s as well. So that's telling. I think it's in that regard that South Africa really stands out, because South Africa was not an all-race democracy. It wasn't a democracy in which most people could participate democratically until 25 years ago, which is a similar time to those other countries which are still enjoying democracy. So we still have that thing in living memory of how terrible it is to live under an authoritarian regime. And yet our democratic leaders, representatives, have performed so poorly in the last 10, 15 years that they have discredited they've discredited not only themselves but also the system that has put them in power. And it's just generally a very dangerous and stupid thing to do. And I think it is something that's done on the left and on the right. If some scientists are doing a bad job, there's a temptation to say, well, science is the problem. If some police do a bad job, it's a temptation to say, well, the police are the problem. And if some democratically elected representatives do a bad job, it's tempting to say, well, democracy is the problem. No, it's just the particular people occupying those positions of authority. I don't like to be called a millennial. I think, you know, there's a lot of definition creep in that, but whatever, if I'm going to be categorized in that group, I will say that I think we, as disaffected as we are by the job market, we should be using our extra time and our extra access to the internet to be more informed and find more precise ways to apply pressure to get better people in the seats rather than to try and throw the bus off the edge of the cliff.
Indeed. I think also something that's often not mentioned, you mentioned the property market earlier. And one of the problems there is that there's been a lot of this approach to not in my backyardism or NIMBYism. And especially in first world countries, but also to a degree, I think in South Africa too, there's been an awful lot of closing down of new house building and that kind of thing, because people who are already invested in suburbs and established in the property market don't want to let new players get in for fear that it'll damage their property values. And so you've seen also on environmental grounds, a lot of cities have restricted the amount of space available for building housing. And I think this is partially pushing up housing costs, especially in the first world.
And so the point there is it hurts entry-level gangsters.
Yeah. Right, and because it's protecting the property value of people who are already sort of in the market. Terence, sort of as a final thought on this, can you see any obvious way forward that you think we can maybe bring people of my generation and Gabriel's generation back to being in favor of democracy, or at least slightly less disillusioned with the system?
And just remember that this is fairly unique in the whole human experience. You know, the ability to choose a government, to hold it to account, however imperfectly, that's not something to be traded lightly. I've seen people who dismiss democracy and say, well, you have to look we have to look to China. Now, the one gentleman who said this was a newspaper editor who had probably have ended up in some sort of house arrest if he was lucky, if he did that in China, if he plowed his career there. So yeah, not perfect by any sense, by any stretch of the imagination, but the alternatives are infinitely worse. You know, be grateful. The perfect is often the enemy of the good.
Indeed. I'd also venture perhaps that federalism and more accountability in government works. And that means, I mean, people need to, in a lot of ways, hold their officials more accountable. I think what's interesting about Germany is that it's extremely federal and has a lot of competitive local elections where people can quite easily make real change in their political structures that rule them. And also South Korea, right? Because they recently removed a president for being corrupt through peaceful, organized protest. And I think that probably also has enthused people with the idea of democracy. Gabriel, what do you make of that before we move on?
Yeah, no, absolutely right. It's a lot like eating good, healthy food. You know, if you get your metabolism used to the fact that when you eat nice protein, then you've got more energy or whatever your favorite thing is, it can take a bit of an adjustment. But once you feel the reward of putting in the investment, but I'm using food because you don't have to have money to put in the investment in a democracy. You have to apply your mind, you have to apply your attention, and then you have to apply your voice. And I think when you feel rewarded by that, seeing changes in power, peaceful transitions in power, then that's very positive. The only problem, of course, is that many of the youth are like pushing for changes, pushing for accountability in the wrong ways. And again, just sort of vague reference to a place like the United States where people want to abolish the police force in toto rather than say, look, here's a bad policeman, that person needs to go to jail. So there's applying your mind doesn't just mean shouting your opinion very loudly. It also means grounding it in facts. But as I say, once people feel the reward of that, then they're much more likely to do it again and do it seriously.
Right. And I think part of that is that in some respects, they are not particularly well served by older people who have been encouraging a lot of these kind of radical things You know, I'm thinking in the case of the US, a lot of people's professors are out there banging the drum to abolish the police and encouraging their students to be revolutionaries at all times. And so that's certainly not helping. Anyway, I'm sure this is a discussion that we can come back to in another episode. But let's move on now to a South African story. And of course, there are now, as infections soar across the United States and Europe, there are fears that South Africa may be headed for a second wave of COVID-19. South Africa's Professor Salim Abdul Karim, who has widely been hailed as the sort of chief epidemiologist of the government's response, Gabriel and I have talked about him a bit in the past, in not very favorable terms, he has warned the public that a second wave of COVID-19 infections is, quote, inevitable unless we see immediate changes in some behaviors. He said, I hope that we have all learned how to live with the virus. If we can keep the transmission at its current level between 1,000 to 2,000 cases a day, we can make COVID-19 endemic to this country. However, we are seeing things like the Tin Roof outbreak, the Fort Hare party, and huge gatherings in Northwest. These events make a second wave inevitable. And he said, we have to worry about three things, complacency, mass gatherings, and easing travel restrictions too early. He said, countries like Spain are now struggling because they reopened their borders quickly. They've tried to capture the summer tourism boom, but instead they've ended up with a second wave. So, Gabriel, let me start with you because I think you've read a lot about COVID in South Africa. Over the past couple of weeks, we've seen, I think, the seven-day average for the positivity rate, so that is the number of COVID tests that come back positive, is about 8.1 over the last week. We only had, I think, I'm just looking for it here, 11 deaths in the past 24 to 48 hours in South Africa. Excess mortality seems to have stopped going up, according to the government statistics. Do you think that we're headed for a second wave? Is this the lull before the storm?
Okay, I think it's a very serious question. To answer this question from a database point of view, one has to recognize the constraints that the data impose. So we don't know how many people have or have had SARS-CoV-2 in South Africa this year. So that's one variable. The other variable is we don't know how many people have antecedent immunity to SARS-CoV-2. Now, one of the reasons I criticized Professor Salim Karim is that at the start of this, he said the SARS-CoV-2 is a completely new virus. He said this in April, and so he completely dismissed the possibility of antecedent immunity. But, epidemiologists around the world noticed that SARS-CoV-2 is called SARS-CoV-2 because it's like SARS-CoV-1, and we've had coronaviruses before. And often people have some level of cross immunity based on T cells that they've developed, antigens that they've developed to previous infections. So the thing is, because we don't know both of those variables, we don't know how much to attribute to the one or to the other. In other words, it could turn out, and then the third thing we don't know. Which is not a variable input. It's the core issue is how much our testing has changed over time. So it's hard to make some extrapolations. But let's just say the two factors are: we don't know how many people have had it or have it, and we don't know how many people are antecedently immune. That matters because if it turns out 20% of people are antecedently immune, but half South Africans have had it, that means 30% of South Africans are still exposed to it. And that means that if we all went for a big party tomorrow and everyone kissed everyone else on the lips, then you'd have a huge portion of the country that suddenly gets the disease. And then you'd have that sort of disastrous scenario where people are dying that wouldn't otherwise die because there's no access to healthcare. So that'd be with a relatively small amount of antecedent immunity and even still quite a high amount of people that have already had the disease. But if 40% of people are antecedently immune and 40% of people have had the disease, then it's only 20% that are potentially vulnerable. And at that point, you reach what epidemiologists call saturation. It's such a small potential part of the population is vulnerable that it's actually hard for the disease to get there. So you'd literally have to go and smooch everyone would have to smooch everyone in order to get it. If you just went about your daily business, the virus would continue to slowly percolate through, but it would hit many people who've already had it or are antecedently immune, and so hit dead ends there, and so it'll crash itself out. So that's the sort of scientific structure, I think, of how to think about this problem. And one of the grievances I have is that we have so little local data to think about this that's publicly available, even though we theoretically should have the resources to make those data available. So one thing that I have in mind, for example, is Discovery, which keeps very close track of all of its members and has been prepared happily to use testing figures from its members to make public information available about the virus. What Discovery hasn't done, so it came to a position that at the start of September, that a third of the country, or 13 million people, had or had had the virus. They didn't provide their rate of infection estimation on the back of that. So it's not clear whether they think that the virus spread to 13 million people, basically, to 10 million people in the first 2 months, and thereafter extremely slowed down in a way that's not been seen anywhere else, or whether they thought that actually lockdowns had no impact on the numbers. It's just continued to grow steadily at the same rate. If they thought the latter, if their data showed the latter from their own membership, then we'd have one picture, and that'd be a picture in which a second wave is very unlikely, because it would seem as if the main break that's actually being put on the virus is natural antecedent immunity. But if they thought the former, if they thought that, you know, there was this huge spike, but then lockdown, especially the second waves of lockdowns, pulled it down, then there's still room to believe that we could have a second wave. We'd be given more confidence in making our estimation if Discovery would disclose its R factor, its rate of infection, across time. And I've been trying to reach out to get them to do that. I haven't had any success yet, but I'll keep going. And the same point could be made at a much more expansive level about the Command Council's willingness to talk about how testing has changed and what's going on with their investigations into anti-immunity prevalence. But yeah, so I mean, the long and the short of it is given the paucity of good, reliable, publicly available data, I can't say with a very high level of certainty whether I think that a second wave is realistic or not. But I do think that the best available evidence suggests that there will be no second wave, that in fact we have de facto stopped socially distancing. I mean, people in fancy urban centers have continued and will continue to do so, but that people in the rural areas, people in CBDs and townships, the high density areas where the virus is more likely to spread anyway, have stopped socially distancing effectively since June. And so we've hit our peak of what is going to change based on human non-pharmaceutical interventions. What's really holding us safe, insofar as we are safe, is stuff beyond our control. And so, yeah, that's how it looks right now. But I think for government to make it a hard decision on that basis, it would want to deploy or employ data that is that's a bit more stringent than what I, as a member of the public, have access to.
Right, and I think it's very worth remembering. It's very important to remember that COVID has defied a lot of predictions from a lot of sides. I think that it can be a little bit difficult to make a call on it, but generally, I think you probably are right. I think that we maybe haven't we probably actually because our lockdown was such a failure. That it has run through a lot of the population already. But of course, we shall see. Terence, do you agree with Gabriel's sort of final assessment there? And do you have any words of wisdom, you think, for thinking about this topic?
Yeah, look, for me, the more important question is that if we do start to see evidence of a second wave taking place, how do we respond to it? I think that the lockdown was great if you're in a position to lock yourself down. That's a bit of circular reasoning there, but anyway, how do we take what we've learned and run with it, assuming we've learned anything at all? You know, I think we're, for instance, going to be stuck with masks for a long time. And I think, you know, a definitive account of all this is going to be is still going to be some years away. But yeah, you know, hard times ahead potentially.
Indeed, I think that's probably right. A British journalist called a young guy called Tom Harwood suggested on Twitter that no one will know which approach was ultimately right for years to come. This pandemic potentially has a long way to run. Jumping to judgment after the first wave alone may well lead to red faces. It may not. Moral certainty at this point is folly. I think that's a pretty good rule of thumb. I think, you know, I'd say that we do know probably about more about what doesn't work than about what does work, than he suggests. But I think moral certainty is probably a little bit folly. Anyway, at the risk of igniting even more conversation, let's quickly move on to our last topic today, very briefly in the last couple of minutes here. And this is a story that broke last night, and that the Zondo Commission, which appears to be ever-growing in its scope, has decided that it wants to investigate the affairs of Police Minister Bheki Cele and companies linked to him, as well as the late ANC Durban chairperson John Matshunu. Cele and Matshunu were political allies and business partners in several companies. Matshunu died in 2010. Four companies linked to Cele have been flagged by the Zondo Commission, in three of which he is still the active director while he has resigned from it. Cele's spokesperson said that the minister declared these financial interests to Parliament and has no knowledge of the subpoena. It's unclear what are the commission's reasons for looking into Cele at this point. So this is quite interesting, I think, because, you know, we've been quite critical on this podcast of the Zondo Commission. But Terence, let me start with you. What should we make of this? Do you think this is some move in internal ANC politics to make sure that Cele stays in line? Or do you think chickens might be coming home to roost for him?
I have always had an element of respect for the Zondo Commission. Once again, it's not perfect, but you know, I do think that Judge Zondo has been willing to ask some tough questions and tread on some toes. What does this mean? I don't know. You know, a commission can only try and expose facts and make recommendations. It can't prosecute, and I think that's always the failsafe. That, you know, we can dig all this stuff up, but ultimately, what becomes of it rests with others. I do think that Minister Zele has led a particularly charmed life. You know, it's from being an MEC in KwaZulu-Natal to the chief of police, you know, he's then declared unfit to hold office and you know, recycles as the minister of police. Interestingly, Dr. Johan Berger from the Institute of Security Studies rated his performance as the chief of police fairly well. He was very operationally focused, but you know, I think even if the intention in setting up the Zondo Commission was you need to have it sort of aired and then quietly forgotten, these things can at times develop a life of their own. It was Oswald Pirow of the former regime who once said the problem with politically appointed judges is that they, 6 months later, they assume that they're on merit. And I think the same applies to commissions of inquiry, or can, and I think in this case may.
Gabriel, quick 60 seconds. What do you make of this?
Yeah, so I think that one of the reasons it's important to talk about the esteem economy is precisely to see how limited it is. So yeah, the Zondo Commission has done a good job of humiliating the ANC in public, and this may be a further addition to that. But it's my position that most South Africans were already all too aware of how nasty and how deeply the rot had set. And what they really wanted was a viable solution, which has to be force. The only way to deal with criminals is force, is to get prosecutions. I think that you look to the Nugent Commission on SARS. Judge Newton made recommendations before the completion of the commission. He said, I've got enough evidence here to suggest that you fire Tom Mayani, for example. Zondo has exactly the same prerogative. He could do exactly the same. He could make provisionary recommendations on the way, which, given his terms of reference, which are defined by Zuma very broadly, means that he could keep going on forever. Might as well make recommendations on the way, and might as well make provisional findings on the way, which is another way of saying making recommendations, so that we can get on with the job of putting people behind bars. It's enough already. We need big corrupt people behind bars.
Right. And of course, the other story that we didn't get time to mention today is that the EFF leadership, Julius Malema, Floyd Shivambu, are also, I believe, going before the Zondo Commission, particularly relating to their financials and their involvement with the VBS bank heist, for which there is substantial evidence that they were very, very tightly involved with. So that might be in some ways be more damaging to the EFF, because they're sort of, not entirely in the bosom of government. But we shall have to see. Anyway, that's all we have time for today. Thank you very much for listening. Please subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. Please leave us a review. Thanks very much for listening, everyone. And we will see you tomorrow on The Daily French Show. Have a great day, everyone.